Hi, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in East Asian Studies. Welcome, and thanks for joining me today. I recently spoke with Xiajue Wang about her new book, Modernity with a Cold War Face, Reimagining the Nation in Chinese Literature Across the 1949 Divide. This came out with the Harvard University Asia Center in 2013. Now, the book takes the year 1949 as its pivot point. This is the year that marks the beginning of communist rule in mainland China and the move of the nationalist government to Taiwan. But what Wang does is she contextualizes 1949 within a broad international Cold War context, and in doing so, really helps us re-envision how we understand not just the importance of 1949 as a pivot point, but also how we understand modern Chinese literature within a more global transnational context. So after situating us within the larger context of the emergence of Chinese literature as a discipline and introducing us to the major loci of the study, that is mainland China, Hong Kong, and Taiwan, most of the book takes us into a series of chapters that each introduce a particular author and that author's work as a way of giving us a different kind of entry point into the ways that a modern Chinese nation was imagined or reimagined during the 1949 division. So over the course of these chapters, there are lots of ways in which this study intersects with and informs lots of different areas of not just the history of literature, but also modern Chinese history and global history more broadly. And so we learn about the histories of collecting and sort of museum collections and their intersection with history. We learn about schizophrenia as it's understood in this context. She brings us into the history of socialist realist writing, especially in Chapter 3, and you'll hear about that. We also learn a lot about Taiwanese literature in a number of different contexts. We learn about translations of German literature, poetry and prose, in some really interesting cases in Chapter 5. We also are brought into Cold War Hong Kong, in a really interesting case study that looks at Eileen Chang, and you'll hear about that over the course of the conversation. So over the chapters of the book, it's not only a collection of really fascinating cases that will open your mind up to films, sort of literary works, and other kinds of discourse that you might not be aware of, but it's also a book that speaks to and opens up a lot of different kinds of connections between modern Chinese literature and other fields. So it was a pleasure for me to talk with Xiaojue about it and to read the book. And I hope you also enjoy it and have a chance to take a look at the book after the interview. So enjoy. We're here today to talk with Xiaojue Wang about her new book, Modernity with a Cold War Face, Reimagining the Nation in Chinese Literature Across the 1949 Divide. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, Xiaojue, and thank you so much for making the time to talk with me today. I really loved the book, and I'm really looking forward to talking with you about it.
Thank you so much, Carla, to have me today on your show. It's a great pleasure.
Thank you. So, Xiaojue, could you start us off, as is traditional for the channel, by just saying a little bit about yourself and your background, and specifically, what brought you to the field of modern Chinese literature?
Okay. Actually, you know, I was initially trained in German language and literature. So it was by accident that I later, you know, moved on to comparative literature and in particular to the Chinese literary and cultural tradition.
So that's actually really interesting because one of the later chapters looks specifically at this relationship between German and Chinese literature in a really interesting way. So we'll make sure to get to that over the course of our conversation.
Thank you. You're really a very careful reader.
Oh, no. So the book that we're talking about explores very, very broadly put, and we'll get into more detail and more nuance over the course of our conversation. It explores mid-century, so mid-20th century Chinese literature in a global Cold War context and looks at a series of figures who are individually and in different places in different ways, but using similar or as part of a similar broad phenomenon, reimagining and struggling with what 1949 means in the context of China, of identity, of modernity, and of many other really, really interesting concepts and events. And we'll get to those in turn. So how did you come to this particular topic as a focus for your research? How did you decide to write a book on this topic in particular?
I've been always intrigued by ideas like borders, division, and migration, not just the physical traffic or migration or dislocation, but also the psychological ones, and how this kind of migration, physical and psychological migration, might have affected people, their lives, the way they see the world, and the way literature is written. As I previously mentioned, I was initially trained in German literature, and during my freshman year, I had this German language teacher, an old woman in her 60s from Germany. At that time, it was still, when she came to Beijing, it was still the divided Germany, so the East Germany versus the West. But it was after, during the 3 years she stayed in Beijing and teaching us German language, it happened that the Berlin Wall collapsed in 1989. So for her, it's always, in our conversation with her, she always mentioned, when she one day when she returned to Germany, there was no more East Germany, where she grew up. And so that this kind of ideas of separation or division between the East and the West, I think, is a way through which I actually studied literature and culture. So later, when I came to the United States to pursue my PhD degree, also in German literature, I chose the post-war German literature, so the Nachkriegsliteratur, and I wanted to look at the Cold War division in Germany, originally. But then I happened to take a seminar with Leo Li at Harvard on modern Chinese literature. So I started to realize actually this kind of Cold War division, it didn't just occur, in Europe, but it's very much part of my own, part of the history of modern China. And so it came to me about this idea in 1949 and how the division across the 1949 actually affected not just the Chinese culture, but my parents' generation, and how there's always a before and after. And if this 1949 is really this very mysterious, a defining fault line in people's lives in Chinese literature and culture. So that's how I came eventually to decide on this topic on 1949 and how to bridge it in Chinese literature. And I pick it up as my dissertation research and later for my first book.
So let's talk a little bit about that transition from dissertation to book. Were there any major transformations from one form to the other in terms of how you were thinking about the topic, how you were conceptualizing your arguments, or what the structure of the work wound up looking like?
When I initially started with my dissertation research and writing different chapters, my original idea was to do a comparative work of both the German division and in a Chinese one, around mid-20th century. But then as the work gradually developed, I realized, it was probably an impossible mission to complete within the scope of one single dissertation. So that actually led me to focus primarily on the China side of the story. And my original framework is to think from the perspective of schizophrenia, both as a pathological discourse, but also as a more theoretical term. because some of the stories in that I actually examined in my dissertation, some of those figures, they all went through a very schizophrenic-like stage in their lives, in particular Shen Song Wen, and also, like Ding Ling and so on and so forth. So I thought that it might be a really good entry point to tie together all those very diverse stories. And in the process, so that's the way my dissertation was done. And later, when I started to revise it into a book, I read more stuffs that were recently made available in mainland China, Hong Kong, and Taiwan. And, I started to rethink the entire framework. So I think, what I really wanted to do further in my book is to go from this Cold War mindset into a possible deco-war, critical venue to rethink about the legacy, the posterity of Cold War in contemporary society as well. So here we are in my the current shape of my book, which I actually also added at least two main chapters, the chapter on the literary history, how modern Chinese literary study as a field, as a discipline, actually was resulted from the Cold War division, and also my the Hong Kong chapter, and then later the conclusion, how to hopefully to come up with a deco or critical position, to help us to go beyond this kind of dichotomous mindset of the Cold War era.
Great. Thank you so much. And this actually, what you just said brings us really nicely into the body of the book and into one of the first things that I was going to ask you. So thank you for that. So the book takes as its pivot point the year 1949. This is the year that marks the advent of communist rule, as you tell us in the book, in mainland China, and the retreat of the nationalist government to Taiwan. Now, previous scholarship has used what you call in the book a rhetoric of dichotomy to characterize 1949 as a kind of radical break. So can you start us off by saying a little bit about how your treatment of and your conceptualization of 1949 differs from previous conceptions of 1949 as a kind of radical break? How is what you're doing with 1949 as a time, as an event, or as a time period importantly differ from previous scholarship?
Yeah, thank you. That is actually a very crucial point for me to really conceptualize my project. We've always heard about those, ideas of we have a pre-1949 and we have a new stage, a totally clean slate after 1949. Like in my parents' generation, they would talk, one is like prior to the liberation, right? That's the PRC notion for 1949. And then there was a new world, a new post-liberation world in China, and how that actually just shaped the way people were looking at recent Chinese history and culture. And for me, I mean, this kind of a binary framework, it actually goes further, of course, beyond the everyday life talks about 1949. We're going to see a set of dichotomous notions like socialism versus capitalism, or good versus evil, or we have an authoritarian government versus a free world of China, and we have like the socialist type of modernity versus a more democratic type of modern imagination. And for me, I think, of course, I mean, I actually myself grew up, with that kind of binary rhetoric. But then I started to realize, especially when I started to look at the literary and cultural texts, it's not that easy. This kind of very black versus white division is actually something that will kind of contain our further understanding of that era of the literary and cultural productions that were made possible by writers and intellectuals, or even by, you know, just ordinary people from that era. So I think we during my research, I started to realize we need to look at that era beyond this type of binary, you know, containment. Is there any other thing, you know, or is there any other angle or other, any type of concerns or things going on, you know, beyond or underneath this type of dichotomous setting?
Great. Thank you so much. And so you set this up in the introduction, and you also set up another really important contribution to the way we understand and periodize this period in Chinese literature. And you've already talked a little bit about that when talking about the genesis of the project in the first place, and that is your conceptualization of Chinese literature within a broader Cold War context.
Yes.
And that's another quite unusual innovation in the way that you are thinking about the subject of the book. But since we've already talked a little bit about that, I'll just kind of mention that and tag that and mark that for listeners, because that is a really important innovation in addition to the way you're thinking about 1949, I think. So as we move into the body of the book, we move into a series of chapters that first set up the larger context that you're talking about, and then take us into a series of case studies. So in order to make sure that we have time for these super fascinating case studies, what I'll do is I'll just mention for listeners what's happening in the first chapter, and then we can move on to some examples of that come out in the later chapters. So the first chapter looks at how modern Chinese literature as a discipline was invented, grew up during the early Cold War in mainland China, in Hong Kong, and in Taiwan. And you give us a set piece to understand how literature was understood in the context of politics and culture in each of those three settings, the People's Republic, Hong Kong, and Taiwan, by focusing on a particular text. So you focused on Mao Zedong's 1940 text on New Democracy to talk about the PRC context. You bring us into the New Confucianists' 1958 Manifesto to the World on Behalf of Chinese Culture to take us into Hong Kong. And then for Taiwan, you take us into Chiang Kai-shek's 1953 Supplementary Treatises on Education and Recreation to the Principle of Livelihood. And you talk about that as a kind of archetype of anti-communist literature. So you're already setting up a very multi-sided, local way of thinking about what constitutes the spaces of Chinese literature just from the introduction. And then you take us into a series of chapters 2 through 6, that each explore a different author as a way of giving us a different entry point into this larger process of imagining a modern nation at what you call the Chinese division of 1949. Okay. So let's get to that. So chapter 2 looks at the work of a super fascinating figure named Shen Congwen. So to get us started, can you introduce him for listeners? Who is Shen Congwen, and what do we need to know about him and his background to understand the work that you're doing with him in this chapter?
And thank you for this very nice outline of the first chapter, how I, you know, set up the framework from three different locations and how that actually will, you know, engender different ideas about modern literature and so on and so forth. Yeah, Shen Congwen is always this very intriguing intellectual figure for me. In mainland China, no one talks about Shen Congwen before 1980s. And it was very interesting. He actually, you know, the way that his works were being reintroduced and republished in mainland China, mainly through this seminal work by C.T. Xia, the History of Modern Chinese Fiction, when it was published here in the United States, actually, you know, laid the ground for this field of modern Chinese literary study here in the United States. And he actually dedicated one chapter to Shen Congwen. And then later we're going to see the interest and people getting curious in mainland China. Who is this guy, Shen Congwen? And, you know, what did he do? And what did he write? And what happened to him? So I started to look at him. I mean, for the readers, Shen Cong is the one who was generally regarded as belonging to the so-called May 4th New Cultural Movement generation. He started to write really early in the 1920s and 30s. And especially he's well known for his stories, very fascinating stories about West Hunan, you know, a region we're going to see multiple cultural traditions, you know, and competed with each other. We're going to see the more dominant Han, Chinese or Confucian Chinese traditions together with you know, ethnic minority cultures like Miao culture in Hunan, and we're going to see the local ideas about witchcraft, about wizards, about ghosts, and very fascinating, you know, literary and cultural imaginations, those stories about ghosts, about mad people and how they will possess this supernatural power and potential to go beyond the human world. So that's what shaped Shen Cong's literary imaginations in the 1920s and 30s. But in the 1940s, when he migrated with the majority of Chinese intellectuals, universities, or other institutions to the interior of China, and for him, Kunming or Yunnan province in particular, he started to go through this aesthetic crisis. You know, he felt no more satisfied, no more happy with his previous literary styles. He wanted to pursue alternative ways of an expression and articulation. He thought that language, literary language, might actually impose limitations and restraints on literary imagination. So he wanted to find an alternative form to express his ideas, and he called that his ideas is more about abstract. You know, he's always fascinated by this abstract idea of beauty. So beauty is both concrete but also abstract. And if literature would be the most efficient, form and mode to express those ideas that he felt, or in a really magical way about the nature, about the human creativity. So he started to experiment with different forms of writing, and he thought actually, music or mathematics would be a better way to convey some ideas of human creativity. So when it came to 1949, we're going to see Shen Cong went through a set of even more severe crises. It's not just aesthetic crisis anymore. You know, he went through this vehement attacks from the left, in particular from figures like Guo Moruo, who view themselves as this representative of a leftist, more progressive type of literature and culture. So he was being labeled as this, so-called pornographic writer, writer who is always into something that is not has nothing to do with Chinese society, who were just so decadent, who were not concerned with national survival or the revolution, and so on and so forth. So he attempted to commit suicide in 1949, but very luckily he got saved, but was later sent to this asylum for in a mental hospital in Beijing, because he started to develop all those hallucinations, and people thought he was mad. This was an insane figure. But still, after he recovered from that time period in the mental institution, he started to think if it's still possible for him to write. And he got this news that all his books were got burned and destroyed. No one was cared or interested in his literary production anymore. So that actually pushed him further down to this state of despair. Eventually, he decided, okay, he will go to the Museum of Chinese History, if the government, this new government, allowed him to take that step. So he ended up as a clerk, you know, he's not actually being regarded as an expert of art history, but it's just as a clerk to copy catalogs or the inscriptions for exhibitions. But he took that as a chance of self-education. So he thought that this is a wonderful chance for him to go through all the collections in the Museum of Chinese History, Chinese Culture. And it ended up with this wonderful work that he completed. It's called The History of Chinese Clothes and Costumes and Chinese jewelries and so on and so forth. But he didn't have a chance to publish it until the 1980s. So basically, I think this kind of conversion from literature via this discourse or this institution of insanity eventually leading to this new space of museum. And if he can still preserve certain forms of creativity and critical thinking, that's what I'm very interested in this chapter.
Great. Thank you so much. Now, when we meet Shen in this chapter, there are debates, and he's engaging in debates over the preservation of Beijing. You call it the besieged city of Beijing during the Civil War. And he talks about the role of museums and objects in this context. So this is a really wonderful way to bring us into ideas of materiality and objects in this context. You talk about him as both a collector and as a historian, which is also really interesting for bringing these spaces and discourses of museum and text together in one place. Now, you talk about his work in this context and also in his work on traditional Chinese costumes in terms of an aesthetics of the fragment and of fragmentation. This is a fascinating idea, an aesthetics of fragmentation, an aesthetics of the fragment. So could you say a little bit more about that? Because that seems to me to be a concept that's potentially really, really interesting for, potentially lots of people who are interested in putting together the way we think about collecting and the way we think about history. So an aesthetics of fragments and fragmentation. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, that's an excellent point. It really I mean, the way that I think for Shen Chengwang, how to deal with the history of materiality, the history of cultural creativity, that's something I think that interested him, fascinated him from the very beginning, even during the time when he, tried to establish his career as a writer. He started to have this chance to go through to classify the personal collection first in the 1920s for this military general in Hunan. And that's his first chance to go through the real things, the objects, the artifacts, and beyond the any book wisdom. He had the chance to do that. And then later he was a collector of the Qinghua, right, this Ming Dynasty type of porcelain. And in that process he developed this very distinctive perspective to look at Chinese cultural tradition in terms of those fragmented pieces of artifacts that are remaining from, the history, different types of histories. And in particular, when in the context of post-1949 time, I think when what really puzzled him is there is this overwhelming and overarching discourse of socialist revolution, socialist, reconstruction, a type of monumental narrative to begin with. But for him, he was always more keen to the details, to those different aspects of culture, rather than to build up this total or totalizing discourse of nation or revolution or modernization. So I think But he said, oh, no, what he is exercising is also a type of historical materialism that's been really promoted by Mao, by the Maoist discourse of the time. But for him, this kind of historical materialism is more substantiated in the material history of Chinese culture. So I think by pursuing the fragments or even the vestiges from the history, that's his way to kind of reshuffle them in a framework or in order of things that totally would carve out a different space, in addition to the Maoist more dominant revolutionary or historical discourse of the time.
Great. Thank you so much, Xiaojue. Now, as we move to chapter 3, we move to another really, really fascinating figure that you use to explore another context, and this is the figure of Ding Ling. Now, Ding Ling is a figure whose work lets you look at, in this chapter, what you call a clash between feminist consciousness and socialist revolutionary discourse in her work after the 1940s. So let's talk about that a little bit. Now, the chapter closely reads and focuses on two works by Ding Ling. And the first work that you look at is a work called The Sun Shines Over the Sangan River. So to help us explore what's happening in this chapter and to help us understand how to fit this chapter into your larger argument, can you talk a little bit about Ding Ling for us and specifically explain what is this work, The Sun Shines Over the Sangan River, and why is it important for the kind of argument you're making in this chapter?
Yeah, Ding Ling is a really very controversial figure, but a fascinating woman writer. And she started her literary debut in the late 1920s as this very avant-garde, modern, urban woman writer. And she challenged those ideas of women's emancipation that's being advanced by the May 4th new intellectuals. She said, okay, although you are selling this idea of a new type of woman, of women's emancipation, liberation, but you are actually, most of the intellectuals are male. So you are actually men talking on behalf of us women. So she wanted to find the female voices and female identity from a female angle. She had this fascinating idea that we as women, we can talk for ourselves. We don't need to be represented. We wanted to find our different, very unique voices. So that's her 1930s efforts, trying to give us a series of urban, young women who tried to find their independent position in this newly arising modern Chinese cities, especially in Shanghai and Beijing. But later, she was drawn to this more, progressive ideas of socialist revolution and this communist ideal. So she went through this very tenuous trajectory of from a more cosmopolitan woman figure, but into a more politicized figure. She tried to find this political agency for Chinese women. So she went to Yan'an, the revolutionary center, in the 1940s. And she actually became a friend with Mao Zedong in Yan'an. So she tried to find a political identity on top of the feminist identity. And for her, she tried painstakingly to combine these two sets of new roles for Chinese women. And she got frustrated when Mao issued the talk on literature and arts in Yan'an, which was partly targeted at Ding Ling's more critical reflections on Yan'an's women's stances, if women can automatically be incorporated into the revolutionary course just because they were here in Yan'an, they were part of the revolutionary team, then do they still have their own problems that are different from the men's problems during the revolution and so on and so forth. So Ding Ling was purged in early 1940s because she published the pieces like in the hospital or when I was in the Xia village, which tried to consider women's problems in the revolutionary basis. And after that purge, she realized, you know, we have to probably compromise some of the women's or feminist ideas in order to better fit into the overarching national discourse, which is mostly male-centered. And after that process of so-called self-education, self-transformation, she came up with this piece called The Sunshines Over the Sangam River in late 1940s, which later won the Stalin Literary Prize, actually, so which was being considered by the new socialist regime as the representative work of socialist realism. She saw that she, you know, was able to piece together these two identities for women, you know, the more modern and emancipated, and then the revolutionary, a political role for a Chinese woman.
Great. Thank you so much. Now, as you take us through her transformations over the course of this chapter, you compare the work that she did in Sangam River with another work that she did a little bit later. And this is what you call a socialist realist fairy tale called Duanxiang from 1949. So she later on retrospectively decides that Duanxiang is the best work she ever wrote, and the reasons for this are really interesting. So can you explain what is going on in this work, Duanxiang, and what's important about this work in order for us to understand her transformations over the course of this chapter?
From the Sangam River to Duanxiang, almost 30 years, it was the time when Ding Ning's literary and also political career went down, you know, it really for the second time. She was being purged and sent to the northeastern part of China to go through the labor camp to once again re-educate and transform herself to get more politicized. So that means in the Sangam River, we still see very dubious women characters, which are hard to get categorized into the very clean and strictly divided socialist and hierarchy, you know, along the line of class consciousness. But then in Duanxiang, that is work that she, you know, tried to re-enter the literary and also political arena after the Cultural Revolution. She thought that in Duanxiang, finally, she was able to get rid of those remnants of the so-called bourgeois, you know, dangerous, decadent ideas about women. And then she came up with this more degendered figure, Duanxiang, who is a pure embodiment of a socialist model worker, which is not to be examined, you know, in terms of gender or sexuality.
Great. Now, the chapter is called Over Her Dead Body, and this is actually a play on what happens to her at the end of her life, and really
yes,
her life and circumstance. The Communist Party wouldn't cover her body with a flag at her funeral. And so, again, we see this really interesting physicality and materiality that is an important part of the story, right, with her physical body and the objects that are or are not associated with it even after her death. It's a really nice, I think, way of extending the kind of treatment that you made, or the kind of treatment, rather, that you gave to the previous context when we looked at Shen and his interest in material objects and fragments. And so, again, we have this materiality that follows us through the book in really, really interesting ways. So as we come to Chapter 4, you bring us into the context of Taiwan. Chapter 4 focuses on the work of Wu Zhuoliu, and it focuses on the work of Wu to take us into mid-century Taiwanese literature and look at the ways that modernities are evolving and modernities are emerging in this context. So briefly, can you tell us a little bit about Wu? Who is Wu? What's important for us to understand about Wu in order to understand the kind of intervention you're making and how we understand Taiwanese literature across the divide in this chapter?
Yeah, with Wujoli, we're dealing with a totally different context in Taiwan. Wujoli is was a writer who grew up during the Japanese colonial time in Taiwan. So basically, very interesting thing, this work that I talk about, The Orphan of Asia, it was written in Japanese, so in the colonizers' language. But intriguingly, it's not entirely in Japanese. There are a number of poems that he included in this work. And oftentimes, when the protagonist felt really frustrated or felt really low, he tend to compose poems. And those poems were written in Chinese, in classical Chinese, not just the style, but also the language itself. So it's very interesting, kind of a combination in linguistic, but also cultural terms here. Taiwan, what Wujoliu dealt with is this transition from the colonial period to the retrocession of Taiwan back to China. But this transition is not as, of course, it's not easy on anyone, but it's so complicated because when Taiwan was ceded to Japan, it was then the Qing Dynasty, right? We're talking about the last few years of the Imperial China. But then when Taiwan was returned to China, it was a different China that we're talking about now, is the Republic of China. And then very soon, just 4 years after the retrocession, it's not just one province of Republic of China anymore, but it actually became the physical embodiment of the entire Republic of China when the nationalist regime retreated to Taiwan. And use Taiwan as the final, the last bastion to hopefully to fight against communism in mainland China. So that's what happened on the background in the larger picture of politics and history. But for the writers, what they were dealing with something even more serious. So that it's not just a geopolitical transition for them. It also concerns with the change of language, of what kind of language they could use to express their concerns and their anxiety confronting this 1949 division. Because they grew up using Japanese as this written form of language. They spoke either Hokkien or Hakka at home as this dialect, and they write classical in classical Chinese. But with the 1945 and later 49 changes, they have to start to acquire this new language that is Mandarin Chinese, which itself is a product of the Chinese modernization since early 20th century. So for them, they have to give up. They were forced to quit writing in Japanese because, according to the Kempt regime, this is a tainted language. This is a colonizer's language. You cannot use it to write about what you think. So now you need to use Mandarin Chinese to really express what you think or what you're really concerned about. So for those writers like Wujoliu, this is a huge barrier, this linguistic barrier. How can they really acquire a totally different form of written Chinese or even spoken Chinese within such a short span of time, especially for writers? This is just a huge challenge. So I think that is one thing that they're dealing with. And then another crucial thing that really confronted this group of writers is that how to really deal with this colonial history, how to deal with the different ideas of modernity that were happening in mainland China, in Taiwan, and via the mediation of the colonizer, that is Japan.
Great, thank you. Now, you've already mentioned that one of Wu's important works and one of the works that you focus on in this chapter is a novel called Orphan of Asia. And in fact, you take this as a set piece to explore and to propose a notion that you call orphanization. So orphanization as a way to understand a kind of split in modern Taiwanese subjectivity in this context. So would you mind talking a little bit about that? What is orphanization and how should we understand that concept in terms of what's happening here?
Yeah, the notion of orphanization, came from his work, The Orphan of Asia, and how he conceptualized a Taiwan consciousness, among Chinese ancestral homeland, Japan, and then the local, Taiwan society. And he felt it's abandoned, the protagonist in the novel felt abandoned, betrayed by all those cultural and political entities, and there's nowhere to go, in a kind of embodiment of Taiwan as an abandoned son or as this orphan that's being stranded among different forces in Asia. That is a very powerful and forceful imagery in trope to really come to terms with this very distinctive Taiwanese cultural consciousness. So, and I think it's something that really fascinated me and started me to think about the cultural condition for Taiwan during this time period.
Great, thank you very much. And the if you hear a truck backing up in the distance on campus, you'll hear that the truck is marking how interesting, I'm sure that's going on, how interesting this next chapter is as well. So for the next chapter, we move to a different context, and we move to a figure who I was really excited to read about, because this is a figure who studied, translated, and worked on German literature, and worked on one of my absolute favorite poets, and that is Rilke. So I'm really excited about this chapter. I'm really excited to talk to you about it. This chapter focuses on a figure called Feng Zhi. So can you introduce Feng for our listeners? What do we need to understand about Feng to understand the kind of work you're using him to do in the context of this chapter?
Yeah, Feng Zhi was this... this is really a fascinating figure. I first got to know him because I went to college in Beijing at Beijing University, Beida, into the Xiyuxi, so the Department of Western Languages and Literatures. And Feng Zhi served as the first chair for that department. So the day when I entered Beijing University, all the professors, all my senior, the students, they will tell all those kind of stories about Feng Zhi and how Feng Zhi actually shaped the curriculum of our department. He always asked us, in addition to German literature and language, we need to really read Chinese literature in all those wonderful pieces in classical Chinese and modern Chinese literature. And then later, when I came to do research here on Feng Zhi, I started to realize why he's so concerned of that we should get a better hold of both traditions in order to better understand both cultural traditions, both the German and Chinese one. That actually is part of his own intellectual trajectory. He was one of the most important modernist poet in modern China. He was first of all a German literary scholar. He went to Germany in the 1930s to write his dissertation on Hilke, and he was fascinated by Hilke's poetic writings, but also the other and literary productions. He went to Heidelberg in Germany, wanted to complete his dissertation, but unfortunately the war broke out in Europe, and his former dissertation advisor was Jewish, so was got outcasted from Germany. So Feng Zhi faced this decision, what to do next. So he decided he's going to study more about the romantic tradition in Germany. So he switched from Rilke to Novalis, and he completed his dissertation on Novalis in German romantic tradition of those ideas of an aesthetic creativity. And when he came back to China, he served as a professor in the Kunming, so-called Southwestern University, Associate University in Southwestern China. And he started to teach German literature, in particular Goethe, and Goethe's Faust, Goethe's poetic creation, and so on and so forth. And then he started to also do literary research on Goethe, translated Goethe, Rilke, Novalis, Heiner, a series of German writers and poets. But what really puzzled me or actually fascinated me is his own conversion that he underwent around 1949. You know, he started to say like goodbye to Hilke. You know, he started to condemn Hilke from this wonderful inspiration of his own poetic writing to this decadent, very poisonous figure of capitalism and so forth. So I've been always wondering what happens, you know, if he thought that he could give him all the inspirations, all the sources that of vitality and energy to cope with what's going on in this world. And then why suddenly, just to push him to this radical end of disavowal of the very figure that he respected and admired so much.
So why did he make this transition? Can you talk a little bit about that transformation for Feng and what's significant about his personal transformation that you found in working on this chapter for understanding the larger context of this 1949 transformation in the larger set of arguments that you're making?
Okay. I think basically, you know, in each chapter, I actually discussed one writer or one intellectual who made a very distinctive choice of what to do at the 1949 turning point. So for Feng Zhi, this is a time, you know, it's equally a severe challenge for him, because the type of poetry that he practiced up to that point is something that he already sensed that will be rejected by this new socialist republic. So maybe let me give an example of a few lines that he wrote after 49, which I thought very nicely reflected this change that he decided to take. So there is a few lines from one poem he wrote after 49. So let me just read it. I mean, it's a beautifully written poem, but it says a lot to us about what he really thought at that time. So the line go like this. There was once a naive poet. He wanted to see heaven in a wild flower. A wild flower is indeed very beautiful, but his heaven was rather too elusive. We, however, from this growing western suburb, see our motherland from the capital to the frontier in the hands of thousands of workers has become a blissful heaven on earth. So I think what happened here, what he described, is exactly what he himself, as a naive poet, underwent during that time period. You know, he has always been struggling in between this kind of an aesthetic autonomy, but also he viewed it as both a blissful space, but also as a space that he didn't see any connection with the real world, or as he called it, the people, the crowd. So he wanted to preserve or to cultivate this aesthetic ideal via poetry. But then he sensed that maybe, you know, there is this missing connection to the real world that he found are so important. Previously, with Hilke, he tried to fight the sense of, you know, a poetic solitary. You know, he wanted to find this autonomous potential in poetry itself. Then he started to realize probably the flip side of that is this further isolation, further alienation from the so-called the people or the collectivity. So for him, he wanted to bridge that gap, and it actually conditioned his transition or his conversion from this, Hilke type of very aesthetic type of poetic subjectivity to a more efficient or productive type of poet, or according to himself, is a worker type of poet rather than an aesthetic type, through which he can find this new space or this new position for a poet to join this large collective community in the socialist and China that was emerging at the time.
Great, Thank you so much. And this, in addition to looking at the importance of the notion of poetic solitude that Feng got from his reading of and inspiration from Rilke's work, you also talk about his inspiration from his work on Goethe in terms of ideas of death and metamorphosis. And you talk finally, and I'm just marking this for listeners so that they know all the great, or at least some of the great stuff, in addition to what you've already said in this chapter, he also turns to Dufu as a model of the kind of poet that you're talking about, actually, towards mm-hmm. the end of the chapter. So it's a really fascinating case. And there's another really fascinating case in chapter 6. So our discussion would not be complete without at least making sure that we spend a little bit of time talking about Eileen Chang, and Eileen Chang in the context of Cold War Hong Kong in chapter 6. So Eileen Chang is used as a case study for exploring this other locality, Hong Kong, that's so important to the larger work that the book is doing. So in order to kind of bring us into this case study, could you introduce Eileen Chang for us and for listeners? Who is she? And can you talk a little bit about her work specifically on the dream of the Red Chamber, perhaps, as a way of opening up what's so important, or at least some of what's so important about what she's doing in this 1949 context?
Yeah, Eileen Chang is the so-called, according to C.T. Shea, the most talented writer, not just woman writer, but writer per se in 20th century China. She and her own, background, family history is so tightly connected with modern Chinese history. We just talked about the cession of Taiwan to Japan, and that treaty, the Shimonoseki Treaty, was actually signed by Eileen Chang's great-grandfather, Li Hongzhang. So as we can see that in that background, she from a very young age has already experienced all those kind of different transitions that China and Chinese society went through, from the imperial system to a republic, from a more traditional type of civilization to this opening up to the West or to the larger world. And so she's good at writing stories and essays about this kind of transitional experiences, about the frustration, about the anxiety that people felt in their daily lives when there's something the changes going on that people don't feel that they can really control their own lives anymore. 49 is a time that brought this huge change in her life as well. Now, Eileen Chang studied for a few years in Hong Kong in the 1930s, and then after Pearl Harbor broke out, she went back to Shanghai and started her writing career there. So this kind of an dislocation and displacement via exile or diaspora is always part of the texture of her literary writings. And when 49, when Communist China took control, she actually stayed in Shanghai for a few years. And then later she even wrote two pieces of political fiction that bearing this new ideas of socialism. Although she was known as this apolitical writer who is more concerned with the details of life, of the more feminine side of human civilization. But in the early 1950s, she did and spent some time trying to fit in this new and political environment. But then she felt it's not going to work, so she decided to leave Shanghai, to leave mainland China. She got a chance to go to Hong Kong again, and she spent a few years in Hong Kong in trying to survive as a translator of American literature. So she actually worked with United Service Information Service in Hong Kong, translated some work like Hemingway or Emerson. And in addition to her own literary writings, she completed two political novel again, but this time it's anti-communist novel, before she eventually decided to leave Hong Kong. She thought Hong Kong is also not the permanent space for her. She would like to go further away from mainland China, and this time she chose to come here to United States, where she actually spent the rest of her life here. Never go back to mainland China again.
Great. And so in the chapter, you take us from this 1950s anti-communist fiction that she's writing in Hong Kong, and you introduce us to two works, The Rice Sprout Song and Naked Earth. And you talk a little bit about her work on Dream of the Red Chamber that follows. And this is actually a really fascinating context. You take us through her effort to actually rework the Dream of the Red Chamber, or Hong Lo Meng, in film. This is ultimately not super successful, just in terms of its, it doesn't get filmed, if I'm remembering correctly. But then she does this really fascinating work called Nightmare in the Red Chamber, which is obviously a play, right, on Dream of the Red Chamber.
Yes.
And you take us into this work on Nightmare and the Red Chamber as a way of taking us into what you call her aesthetics of desolation and a poetics of the quotidian. So what's going on there? Can you just say a little bit about her work on Dream of the Red Chamber and what's important for us to understand about that work in order to understand how to contextualize Eileen Chong within the larger set of transitions that you're marking across this 1949 divide?
Yeah, thank you. I mean, her project on Dream of the Red Chamber is truly something that is so amazing for me. Now, she started really early to read that work, right? We all know this Qing Dynasty novel, how that actually shaped a lot of Chinese, modern Chinese writers' worldview. Before Eileen Chong, in particular, what appeals to her is the way that Dream of the Red Chamber is dealing with human civilization and it's the collapse. There is always this sense for her that the civilization will just end here. We're going to deal with more destructions caused by all kind of human forces, be it war or revolution or socialism and so on and so forth. But what can we do against this background of destroy, of this one day the civilization will just be over, and can we still survive, and what can we do, and so on and so forth. So as you mentioned, this aesthetic of desolation, she thought that is something that she can so well conceive from her reading, from her interaction with Dream of the Red Chamber. In Dream of the Red Chamber, this is a way that the author deals with from the quotidian moments of daily life to write about this destructive force of human desire, the destructive force of when the civilization develops into this excessive obsession with this details, with this the human desire, then it will just came back and by the civilization itself. And for Eileen Chong, especially in the 1950s, this kind of sense of destroy, of desolation, if she feels it even more incisively because of her own experiences of exile in diaspora. So she started to work on a film script for this piece. She tried to manage this really almost impossible mission to adapt this really tremendous work into a film script. She actually took at least three years to work it, and she thought, how to deal with this kind of work that defines any very easy and translation from one medium into another, how to really reduce it into this very coherent, enclosed form of a film that 2 hours or 3 hours. And at the time when she was dealing with this film adaptation, there are different efforts, in mainland China, in Hong Kong, in Taiwan, there are other people there doing the same thing. But mostly what they are doing is to give a very, a tragic form to package and Dream of the Red Chamber, to rewrite it into very, neatly shaped love story, love triangle story, a love tragic and so on and so forth. But for Eileen Chong, that is just too easy. That actually is a betrayal of Dream of the Red Chamber. She thought that what makes Dreams of Rachamba, such a great work, is exactly, you know, this kind of defiance against any melodramatic, this kind of way to look at life, love, or romance. So she, in her efforts, you know, we can read from her letters or diary entries of the time, she wanted, or even in Nightmare of the Red Chamber, she wanted to do something that is more plain, you know, that is not so dramatic. And in this plain way of dealing with life, you know, to give life a more ordinary look as life is something that she thought is so modern about Dream of Red Chamber. She thought that is definitely something that really occurred in the history of Chinese fiction. You know, it doesn't pursue a happy ending. You know, it didn't give you those tear-jerking moments. And so that's also, as I discussed in my chapter, what caused the eventual, you know, the result that people are not so interested in her way of rewriting Dream of the Red Chamber. So eventually it got shelved. They didn't want to shoot it into a real film. Actually, probably it's not such an interesting film, you know, if we follow Annie Chang's way of reading. So she eventually, she actually very interestingly spent 10 more years on Dream of the Red Chamber, but this time not to translate it into a film, a medium, but this time she chose this textual analysis, like this kind of interpretation and reading and academic research on Dream of the Red Chamber, and try to show us what she thinks that is so modern, that is so fascinating about this piece of classical Chinese literature.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Xiaojie. Now, we're almost at the end of our time, but I don't want to close without giving us a chance to talk just a little bit about one of the really important kinds of work that you're doing in the epilogue. The epilogue is called Toward a De-Cold War Criticism. And in the epilogue, one of the things that you're doing is suggesting something that you call, as the title indicates, a De-Cold War Criticism. So perhaps as a way of bringing us to a close, could you talk a little bit about that? What is a de-Cold War criticism as you're advocating it here in this epilogue?
Yeah, the reason that I wanted to think more about Cold War and its legacy is because I felt that it's still here with us. You know, it's still lingering. Although we're saying that we are now in a post-Cold War, or as some scholars call it, post-post-Cold War time. But I thought that actually the Cold War ways of thinking, it remains, you know, very resiliently with us today. Even, you know, if we tune in the radio show today, when Ukraine crisis broke out, everyone will pose the question, are we in yet another Cold War time? And is the Cold War not over yet? So it actually challenges me, you know, it actually propels me to think how to put an end to the Cold War, not just as a historical event or as a, you know, historical indicator of time, but it's something that there is this kind of, you know, mindset, this Cold War mentality of looking at the world in more binary ways. I think that's why what I propose as a de-Cold War consciousness is not just to say goodbye to Cold War, but to go back, you know, to rethink some of the Cold War moments that probably we can de-Cold War, or we can destruct, or we can think against the grain of the Cold War from within. So for me, I mean, some of those writers, some of those cultural productions, they raised the alternative spaces to really go against this more dichotomous setting of this seemingly unpenetrable cage of the Cold War. So I hope that through the study of the cultural figures of the time and what they really are dealing with, what they wrote about, with what they experimented, even by refusing to write again or to write differently, then maybe we can see, you know, new agencies that will help us to go beyond this kind of trajectory of bifurcation that I call the Cold War.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Xiaojia. Now, there's a ton of material in the book that we didn't have a chance to talk about. It's full of lots more stories and case studies and accounts and concepts than we had time to talk about. Is there anything else about the book in particular that we didn't have a chance to talk about, but that you'd like to mention for listeners, and perhaps especially for listeners who have not yet had a chance to read the book?
If there's one thing I'd like to say a bit more about is actually my book cover. Mm-hmm. You know, if you have a copy here with you, you can see this. What I chose is the image, one image from Xu Bing's installation work entitled Gui Da Qiang, Ghosts Pounding the Wall. And for me, I mean, this notion of ghost pounding the wall, you know, in a very nice way, you know, fit very well into my own interests that are illuminated in this book. I mean, Gui Da Qiang, the notion in Chinese, it actually very well paints this visual image that there is a wall that was built by ghosts. And this wall will, you know, encircle a night traveler, no matter how much the traveler tried, how fast he runs or works, he will actually go in circles within this invisible world's confines. So for me, it actually evokes a range of ideas and connotations that really appeal to me during my research. That is the war image, right? The war, how that evokes the ideas of demarcation, of boundaries, of separation. And also the specter image and the image or the notion about human agencies or human impotence, you know, within the certain confines of the war, as war also indicates, you know, the weight of history, the weight of ideology, the weight of the Cold War ideology of the time. So I think I'm very grateful that Xu Bing, you know, granted me this copyright to use this image here. And the year when I, started my graduate study, it's a year when the Berlin Wall collapsed. But for me, I mean, there are more wars existent everywhere in the world, and especially in the discipline of modern Chinese literary study itself, and how to go beyond the war. You know, it's not just to destroy the war, because there are so many invisible wars that are so hard to destroy. But this kind of awareness that there will be wars, more wars existent, and how we can come to terms of this different forms of demarcation and separation and division, but try to make connections, you know, try to go beyond, try to bridge it, that's something that really interested me.
Well, Xiaojia, thanks very much for spending the time to talk with me today. And now that the book's out, we should probably close by looking forward a little bit. So now that the book's out, what are you working on right now? Are there any projects that are currently inspiring you and prompting some future work?
I'm actually working on my second book, which the book manuscript will be wrapped up very soon. It's a book actually on Eileen Chang. You know, I started my research on Eileen Chang in her Cold War, transition. And after I'm done with that chapter, I felt there's so much more, you know, that should be examined and discussed about this fascinating writer. So, that actually gave me this idea. Okay, I definitely would like to write more about her. And one chapter leads to another, and then it actually evolves into this book manuscript that I entitled tentatively The Edges of Literature, Eileen Chang and the Aesthetic of Deviation. And I briefly mentioned that C.T. Xia introduced and actually canonized Eileen Chang in his work, History of Modern Chinese Fiction. But ever since that, we didn't see any monograph dedicated to her and her work in the English language world. So for me, that is a big gap. I mean, we really need to write something more about her. And for me, the perspective that I took for this book is actually, I hope that through the study of Eileen Chong, and especially her literary and cultural practice across language, we know her as a bilingual writer. So across language, across genres, media, and the boundaries between like high art and popular culture, I would like to reconsider the notion of literature and artistic creativity that's being shaped by the Mayforce cultural project in modern China. I would like to explore the blind spot and the limitations, you know, of this new idea of literature and literary creativity, hopefully through Eileen Chong's case, to really probe the edges of literature and to think if there are alternative ways that we can conceptualize literature and artistic creativity.
Oh, wonderful. Well, best of luck on that project.
Thank you.
Congratulations on this one, and thanks very much for making the time. It's really been a pleasure.
Thank you so much. The pleasure is mine.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.